I wonder if we could start out with you telling us a little bit about your upbringing, about growing up in a small town in the Midwest, in Kankakee, and the values you learned while you were growing up.
Well, first off, I was born in a little town in Iowa called Maquoketa. At a very young age, my father went to work after he got out of school, pharmacy school, for the Walgreens Drug Company and got transferred to Chicago. And after a couple of months in Chicago, he got transferred to Kankakee, which is about 60 miles south of Chicago. It was a rural community with some manufacturing and an industrial, conservative, Republican community. And I grew up and went through the grade school, a public school system here. And I think got a lot of my values from being in the Kankakee area, and I still live here, of course.
You grew up in the church in Kankakee as well, right?
I grew up in the Methodist Church, the First Methodist, Asbury Methodist Church here in Kankakee, and took my communion there many years ago, and still attend.
What are some of the more vivid memories you have of your growing up years, the formative years?
Well, I spent a good deal of my time in the family pharmacy. In 1948, my father opened his own pharmacy, his own family pharmacy in downtown Kankakee, and I spent a lot of my hours there when I wasn't in school. And I played football in high school and basketball, but when I wasn't doing any of those school things, I was at the drugstore, and on occasion I had to wash the dishes and mop the floor. And met my childhood sweetheart then, back when we were freshmen in high school. And we stayed together for all those years and finally got married in 1956, and we've now been married for 48 years.
What kinds of things shaped your view of the world, your attitude toward people?
Well, I think my experience in the drugstore was helpful in that, and of course my family and my mother and father were both loving and caring parents. I had an older brother and an older sister, and being the youngest, why, everybody kind of looked after me. But they were strict disciplinarians and still caring, loving parents. And I spent most of my spare time in the pharmacy on Court Street in Kankakee, doing all kinds of jobs for my father, and he worked hard, and we were made a success of the pharmacy business. We ended up with four stores, and we're in business for 43 years here in Kankakee.
Do you remember being involved in the Methodist Youth Fellowship at church by any chance, or was that going at that time for you?
Well, I don't recall that, but I was at Sunday school on occasion and went to church not as regularly as I should have. As I said, we were in the pharmacy business, and as a result, we were open on Sunday.
And, oh, is that right?
Kept our pharmacy going. But I went to church. My mother made sure I got there occasionally, and not every Sunday, I must confess. But we were there, and we practiced our religion.
You remember who the pastor was then?
I do. He's a fellow that married me. His name was Reverend Morgan Williams. Morgan Williams was there for a long time and did and lived to be a ripe old age. I think he was almost 100 when he passed away.
Is that right? He was a very robust man, as I remember, a very vivid preacher.
He was, and a very good preacher, as I remember. But he married my wife and I back in 1956. So there are some fond memories.
How did you find yourself getting into politics? You went to school. Did you get a degree in pharmacy? You ended up going into the family business for a while.
I have a degree in pharmacy. I went to school at Ferris State College in Big Rapids, Michigan, which is a pharmacy school. There were about four or five people from town here that all went up to Ferris to go to pharmacy school.
And how long did you actually work as a pharmacist?
Well, I worked most of my life as a pharmacist until I became a statewide public official.
And that would have been what year?
About 1981 or 82.
And what made you decide to get into the politics? What motivated you?
Well, I was at that time spending, I had a small family. We had six children, my wife and I. We had five daughters and a son, and we had a big family. We had five children under the age of three at one time. And we've had, I spent a good deal of time in my pharmacy trying to make a living to meet my obligations. And so I would spend 12, 14 hours a day in the drugstore working. And one day my brother, the city fathers of the Republican Party, came to my brother and asked him to run for mayor. And that was kind of our first exposure to anything other than voting to the political arena. And my brother and I, we had to think about it long and hard, along with my mother and father, as to whether Tom would get involved in elective politics. We weren't sure what it might do to our business. And in the end, we felt it was an obligation, and that we owed to the people of community something back. And so Tom ran for mayor, and I got involved in helping him get elected. He ended up being mayor for 20 years. I was then, during that time, asked to fill a vacancy on the Kankakee County Board as a supervisor. And I was appointed and then elected and stayed on the county board for 6 years, where I became chairman of the Kankakee County Board for one term before I was elected to the Illinois House of Representatives. But once again, that was by the Republican county chairman and the political people in the county that asked me to get involved.
What attracted you to political office, or to serving in that way?
Well, I felt an obligation, and felt that what I was going to do was to go to Springfield, Illinois, or at least do my duty for a short period of time, and then go back to my pharmacy and hopefully be able to compete with the Walgreens of the world by creating another chain of pharmacies, but I never got back.
But you found yourself sort of being nudged up the political ladder in Illinois.
Well, I don't know if I was nudged necessarily, but I was in the right place at the right time, and that's probably why I stayed in as long as I did. I went to the Illinois House and got elected, and I spent two terms in the Illinois House. That was 4 years. And then I was in the right position at the right time to become the leader of the Republican Party on the Illinois House, called the Minority Leader. I was elected to that position twice. That was a four-year stint. And then I was elected Speaker of the Illinois House. And that put me in the House for 10 years, from 72 to 82. And I then left the House and ran with Governor Jim Thompson as his running mate on two occasions, and was elected a lieutenant governor for 2 four-year terms. And from there, again, being in the right place at the right time, the Secretary of State's office opened up, and I ran for two terms there and spent 8 years as Secretary of State. And from that office, went on to be governor of the state of Illinois for 1 four-year term.
You really got to learn state politics from the inside out.
Well, I did, and I started from the bottom up, frankly. I was a precinct committeeman here in Kankakee, Illinois, and used to ring a lot of doorbells and hand out a lot of literature.
Early in your political career, about 1979, I think it was, you heard a speaker talk about the death penalty. That was kind of a memorable moment for you. Would you tell us?
Well, it was actually back in 1977 when the after the Supreme Court in 72 had abolished the death penalty across America, and then came back, I think, in 76 or 77 and said states can reinstate the death penalty, but there are certain guidelines that they have to follow. And needless to say, it didn't take long for somebody to introduce a piece of legislation into the Illinois House back in 1977 to reinstate the death penalty. Now, I always believed in the death penalty, and I always believed it was a necessary part of our system, in the judicial system and in the capital punishment system, and but never really gave it a lot of thought. It was there, and it was used to deter crime, and I believed that. And in 1977, when the bill came to the House, I voted in favor of reinstating the death penalty. An opponent of the bill stood up and said, "Those of you that are voting today in favor of reinstating the death penalty, how many of you would be willing to throw the switch?" That's when they electrocuted them in those days. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a sobering thought. And I gave it some thought and said, well, I would not want to be the executioner, but I still think it's a necessary part of the system, and I voted for it anyway. But little did I know, back in 1977, that some 20 years later, as governor, I would become the executioner for the state.
Before you were elected governor, however, there's a crime that happened in Kankakee that touched you personally. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. There was a fellow that lived right out my back door by the name of Steve Small. And Steve Small was a young man whose family had been very successful in radio and television and in media, and had made a great deal of wealth, frankly. And Steve was semi-retired and kind of looked after the family business, but looked after my kids when I was gone and helped me with my house. And used to kind of shovel the snow for me if I wasn't home in the winter. And Steve became, and his wife and family, very close friends of ours. Steve bought an old Frank Lloyd Wright house here in Kankakee and was in the process of remodeling it when somebody noticed that he was in the building and who he was, and realized he was a very wealthy young man. He then proceeded, this fellow, his name was Danny Edwards, proceeded to go to see his girlfriend, and they plotted this kidnap on Steve Small, and they built a coffin in his girlfriend's house. Her name was Nancy Risch, and they built this coffin in Nancy's house, and they went out to a part of the county where the soil is kind of sandy and easy to dig, and they dug a hole, and they put the box in. Then they came back into town, and they called Steve Small about midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning and said that they were the Kankakee police, and that they had somebody that had just broken into his Frank Lloyd Wright house. And if he would come over right away and sign the papers, they could incarcerate these people. So he told his wife he'd be right back, and he went down and got in his car. And when he opened his garage door, why, they grabbed him and threw him into the trunk of the car and put on a demand of $1 million in ransom for his safety. And they took him out to this area and buried him, thinking, I guess, that there might still be enough air for him to live. But he died. And it took them 2 or 3 days before they found who the killers were and that the fact that he was dead. And so that was a very emotional, traumatic event for my family and myself. And when I came time to make a decision about the death penalty, that weighed very heavily on my decision. And I still have some folks, especially here in town, that are a little upset with me on my blanket commutation. That included Danny Edwards, who was commuted from death to life in prison without parole.
Oh, he was on death row then when you did that.
Yes, he was. Danny Edwards had written me a note when I started to take some action on the death penalty. And he said, Dear Governor, don't do me any favors. Please don't take me off death row. I'll take my chances with the federal system, and don't put me into the general prison population. I never answered that letter, needless to say. But then, a few weeks later, after I had made a decision to pardon 4 people that had been tortured to confess to crimes they didn't commit, I got another letter from Danny Edwards, and the letter said, Dear Governor, I didn't realize you had the kind of power that you have. You could pardon me and my girlfriend Nancy Risch because you know we are both innocent, and I could travel with you as the example of wrongfully convicted people. I would appreciate it if you would pardon me and Nancy as well. P.S. But whatever you do, if you can't pardon me, don't take me off death row. I don't want to go into the general prison population. Well, needless to say, I didn't pardon him, but I did commute his sentence, and he's now off of death row and living in the prison population. Life without parole. He's in jail for the rest of his life.
When you were elected governor, you were almost immediately thrust into this issue of the death penalty, and it was very personal for you. What happened almost immediately after you took office?
Well, I was elected in January of 19, in November of 1998, and took office in January of 1999. I was elected in November of 98, took office in January of 99. In February, they released a prisoner that had been 16 years in prison that was innocent. And then not because of anything I did, because the system, not even the system in his case, but the system had already released 9 out of 25 people that they had sentenced to die since 1977 when they reinstated the death penalty.
They released those people. Why?
They released them for various errors and mistakes that had been made in their convictions. That the eyewitnesses recanted their testimony. Jailhouse snitches said they were lying. There were several reasons. There were troubles with the attorneys that represented them. There were problems with the trials. And in the end, those 9 people, along with others in the future, had been declared exonerated and freed from prison. Mm-hmm. And so I took office in January, and in February, the 10th person, a fellow by the name of Anthony Porter, is released from prison after 16 years there on death row as an innocent person. And a group of journalism students went out and found the real killer. Anthony Porter was 48 hours away from being executed. He'd been measured for his burial suit, and he'd ordered his last meal. And he had a very low IQ. And 48 hours before his death sentence, his attorneys went to the courts to have his competency tested to see if he really was incompetent and should be executed. That's when a group of journalism students from Northwestern University jumped in and hired a private detective and started an immediate investigation and did some great work, found the real killer in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and videotaped his confession and got the witnesses to recant their testimony after it was proven that they couldn't have seen what they said they saw from where they saw it. And so Anthony Porter, as an innocent man, after 16 years, had been released from jail. And I couldn't understand how that could happen in America, how that could happen, and I still don't understand how it happens today, how innocent people can sit on death row for years and years and years after having been convicted by a jury without a reasonable doubt, and then to go through 16 or 18 years of the appeals process, never to get an answer and to remain on death row. That was the first time that I really started to take notice of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. You had been a supporter of capital punishment all those previous years of your life, and yet you were...
Yes, I was.
Christian, how did you reconcile those two facts?
The fact that I had seen innocent people exonerated, and had the innocent people had been sent to prison. The Tribune did an extensive series on the death penalty and found many flaws, and all of those things made me wonder about how accurate and how fair and how just our system was. And that's when I started to look at it. And by the time I did came full circle, out of the 25 people that had been sentenced to death row, 13 had been exonerated and 12 had been executed. And I said, those are pretty bad statistics and pretty bad odds. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine why we would have a system that would work that bad. And so I called for a moratorium on the death penalty and said, let's stop this machinery of death until we can find out what we're doing wrong and why we're sentencing innocent people to death row. So I did that, and I appointed a commission. And the commission did a lot of good study for about 2.5 or 3 years on that issue and worked very hard to come up with 85 recommendations to make, if there is such a thing, improvements in the death penalty. But the real charge was to lessen the opportunity of convicting an innocent man and sending them to death row and executing an innocent man. And that's what those 85 recommendations did. they no longer, one of the recommendations was videotaping and confessions. You could no longer take the testimony of a single eyewitness and put somebody on death row. You could no longer use the testimony of a jailhouse snitch to put somebody on death row. And a lot of other legal things that were done that would hopefully eliminate the possibility of executing and convicting and executing an innocent person. And that's how I got to the point where I am. Once we stopped that system and made those recommendations, we had, I think, a good proposal. Now, between that time, right after the Anthony Porter case, the Porter case was in February. In March, the first death sentence case was sent to me as governor from the Supreme Court. And they had a fellow that that was due to be executed. After having looked at the Anthony Porter case and wondering whether we had made a mistake or could have made a mistake in this other case, the Corchialis case, I called a delay in his execution and studied it thoroughly, went over it, called in the prosecutors, called in the defense people, spent a good time of studying the whole case. And in the end, I decided that Anthony Corchialis was guilty, and we executed him. There's no doubt in my mind he was guilty. But I said to myself, who am I to make a godlike decision in taking another person's life? And so I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. So I put a moratorium on. That's when I put the moratorium on, and we said we weren't going to have any more until we found out what we could do to improve the system.
What were some of the other measures that you took as governor?
Well, after we got our recommendations from the commission, we introduced them into the General Assembly in the form of legislation to make new laws to make these things happen, that you could no longer have a single eyewitness or jailhouse snitch. You had to videotape confessions. Those things were all put into the legal terms and sent to the General Assembly for passage. There was a Democrat House and a Republican Senate. I was down to where I had just a short period of time left in my term as governor. And the Democrat House passed out three or four of the measures over to the Senate, but the Senate just buried them and refused to act on them. It was an election year, and they decided that
but
no action...
But you were a Republican governor, yet they didn't back you up.
Well, that's right. They decided that... no action was better than any action they could take. It was an election year, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't have to make a decision. They wouldn't make any decisions because they didn't want to risk the loss of a few votes or votes anyplace for any of their members. So as a result, they didn't take any votes on it. And as I neared the end of my term, I had to make the decision about what I was going to do. And the decisions that I talked with and thought about were three, really. Take no action at all, let things go on like they were. Commute every sentence of everybody on death row to make sure that there weren't any innocent people executed. Or to go through and select the people that I thought were innocent and commute their sentences to life in prison and let them prove their innocence later.
How many were on death row at that time?
167. Actually, there were 171, but I pardoned four earlier than about 4 days before I did the commutations on the 167. But I cleared out death row. One of the requests that I had mainly from the families of the victims and the prosecutors was that I take each case individually and make a decision about what they should do. And they specifically ask that I not commute the sentences of everybody in a blanket fashion. But I did that, and I spent a good deal of time in the last few months of my term as governor, and I studied each case individually and went over each case and found a very common thread in every case of violence and murder and rape that these people were sent to die for. And that common thread was just that. It was violence. It was children that were never loved or cared for, somebody that... led a violent life and had mothers that they weren't sure who the fathers were, and it was just it was a terrible existence for those people from the time they were born until they become adults, and all they ever knew in their childhood was violence. And so that was one of the reasons that I made the decision that I did. I looked at each case individually and said, look, I don't know whether these people are guilty or innocent, and I really have no way of telling. Other people had been found guilty by a jury, sentenced to die, and were exonerated, 13 out of 25. How can I make a determination who's innocent here? I don't really know. The safest and best way for me and for those people on death row was to just do a blanket commutation and put them all in prison for the rest of their life. And if they're innocent, they'll at least be alive to have the opportunity to prove their innocence. If they're executed, there's not a chance.
And what was the reaction?
Well, the reaction was mixed, but I think most people that I talked with, at least, felt that I did the right thing on the moratorium, that if we were going to have a system in America that was as final as the death penalty, then we needed to have a system that worked right and worked with perfection. And if we didn't, then we had to ask ourselves as a society, what level of error do we want to tolerate in the death penalty? A 1% error, a 5% error, a 1/10th percent error? And I've came to the conclusion that I couldn't tolerate any percent of error, that we couldn't afford to have the smallest fraction of an error in the death penalty system. And as a result, that's what I did. But there were people that are willing to accept some error in the death penalty system. Some say 10, 5. Some just say it's inevitable. And if you're going to have the death penalty, you're probably going to execute some innocent people. And that's the price we pay for the society we live in. I don't agree with that. I see no need for the death penalty today, which means I've now come full circle. I've come from being somebody that favored the death penalty to somebody who now wants to abolish the death penalty. I can see no reason for the death penalty, and I have yet to find anybody that can give me a good argument for the death penalty. And when you poll today, when the poll question is asked, do you favor life in prison or without parole or the death penalty, life in prison with parole and the death penalty run pretty even. Most people agree that maybe the death penalty ought to go, or I shouldn't say most, at least part of them.
Talk about your experiences with the families of victims. In doing your research, the hearings that you had,
we had a lot of hearings.
They were a factor, were they not?
That was based primarily on the actions of the prosecutors. We had requested written testimony that we could study and read and look at without putting the families through the agony of going through their stories again. But the prosecutors insisted on having public hearings, and so we did. We had several days of public hearings, and I listened to almost all of the hearings in my office. I had it piped in and watched a lot of it on television to see what was there. In addition, I met with the families of the victims on two or three occasions and heard what they had to say and talked with them and listened to their desires. And in the end, I knew that I had to make the decision. And I had a very emotional time in my life. It was kind of a roller coaster where I went up and down. I talked to people and they'd say, we know this fella killed my parents and he should be executed. And I would say, that sounds like a case for the death penalty and maybe you're right. And then I talked to a fella that was a friend of mine who I'd gone to high school with, whose son had committed a terrible crime here in Kankakee, shot a police officer. And he came to me and wanted to know if I was going to kill his son. I said, well, I don't know if I could do that, and but I don't know yet what I'm going to do. So up until the last few days of my term as governor, I really didn't know myself whether I was going to blanket commute all of those prisoners or whether I was going to do any of them or whether I was going to do none. And in the end, I said that I didn't want to look over my shoulder in the future and have missed an opportunity to save a person's life by not acting. And so I took the actions, the safest action that I figured I could take, and that was to commute the sentence of everybody on death row so I don't have to worry about any of innocent people that may have been there. I would guess that most of the people, probably a big percentage of the people, and maybe even all of the people that I commuted, were guilty of the crimes they committed. But if there was one there that amongst them, then I made the right decision.
What was the reaction of the families of the victims?
Well, they were very unhappy, and some of them still are, and wish me the worst. But I understand that, and there isn't anything, I can't think of anything that's worse for somebody to lose a loved one in a violent manner. But when you look at the system, if you can't have one that works fair and just and honestly, then you shouldn't have a system, and that was my concern. Now, I believe that what we should do with any effort that we have now, and even when we were executing people, it cost about $3.2 million on the average for an execution, and it cost about $600,000 to keep somebody in prison for the rest of their life. And so the monies that might be saved by not executing people should go to the families of the victims that have been through a lot of pain and suffering and have had the added expense because of it. And there ought to be some way to compensate those people for their loss.
Did the reaction on the part of the victims' families shake your resolve at any point?
No, it didn't shake my resolve, and I understood their grief. But they all told me that they were looking for closure to the issue, that somehow they felt that this would bring an end to their agony. And I don't believe that, and I don't know that that there's anything that'll ever bring an end to their agony. But I know now that they know where they stand, and if there's such a thing as closure in that case, I would guess that life in prison without parole maybe has given them closure to some issue that affected them. Whether they're satisfied with that or not, I can't tell you. Probably not.
So where do you go from here?
Well, I'm going to continue to work hard to abolish the death penalty, to see that it's a thing of the past. We've come a long way with the execution of people in this country to where it's less barbaric than it's been, but it's still pretty barbaric. When you think back of the days when we used to hang people in public hangings, and then we shot them in public shootings, then we electrocuted them and gassed them, and now we're down to where it's bloodless and it's without violence, and we put a prisoner to sleep and take him into a chamber, let an audience watch as they inject poison into his veins and he falls off into a slumber death that is painless and bloodless, and that makes it more culturally acceptable, and so people are less likely to be upset about an execution that goes on in that fashion. And to think about how Jesus died on the cross and the floggings and the beatings and the punishment that he went through before he died, if we had those kinds of things today, the public would be up in arms screaming about it.
How true. What kinds of things have you done in your quest for a worldwide moratorium?
Well, I have traveled all over the United States, mostly to universities, talking about and talking with young people, basically, in law schools and to law students and anybody that'll listen, basically. I've been in Europe on several occasions where they don't have the death penalty. In any of the European countries, there isn't a country in Europe that's got the death penalty, and they're for abolishing it. And they have problems understanding how we as Americans can continue with such a system. But earlier this year, in April or May, I was in Geneva, Switzerland, where I addressed the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. And we were able, with the help of the European Union, pass a resolution for a moratorium on the death penalty. And I think if we can get people around the world to stop and look at the death penalty punishment as cruel and unusual and bad, or at least to stop and look and see if their system is as flawed and as corrupt and as rotten as our system is here in America, then maybe they'll call a moratorium and study their system as well, and they can stop the whole machinery of death. In the world today, the United States is the third largest executioner of its criminals. We're behind China and Iran, and I think Vietnam. And so we shouldn't be in that kind of company on a world scale, and we really need to have a hard look on the worldwide stage about whether we're going to have a death penalty or not. And that's what I've encouraged.
How likely do you think it is that that might happen?
I think eventually that it'll happen, and especially here in America. I think we'll be able to eliminate the death penalty in America based on the attitudes that I've seen of a lot of young people, the next leaders for this country, the next generation looks at things a little different than some of us that go back several years and about the death penalty. And I think they'll make the changes to abolish it when the time is right for them.
What role, if any, do you think the churches of this nation ought to or could be taking in this?
Well, I think the churches all ought to be involved, and they say that they are. Although, and I hate to be critical, I haven't seen a lot of action from the churches other than that they claim that they're and they are. They don't mean to be say that they're not, but I haven't seen a lot of action from the churches in being involved in the elimination of the death penalty.
What kinds of things could a single local church do?
The whole issue here is one of education. The death penalty is a human rights issue. It's an issue that affects not only the families of the victims, but the families of the perpetrators and society generally. And so it's an issue of human rights that the church should be involved in. And to do that, I think we have to educate people about what it really is and what it means, what the death penalty means and how it's administered and how poorly it's administered in our country and how bad the system really is. And that's the part that we need to bring to people's attention. And I think back of my earlier days when I supported it, I thought it was a true and just system. When I had to find out about it and when I became the executioner and studied it, I realized how bad it really is. It's a racist system, and I don't know if it's racist by design, but that's the way it works out. And we ought to find a way to look at it and to eliminate it altogether.
When you finally meet your maker, what do you hope, or would you like to imagine God saying to you as you approach the pearly gates?
Well, there's a verse in the hymn, "Amazing Grace." Once I was blind, but now I see. And once I was blind, and now I see. And I would hope that God would say to me, you did the right thing at the right time and saved a human life. And you can use all of the Bible quotes that you want to talk about, an eye for an eye. But there were 10 commandments put out, and one of them is, thou shalt not kill. And I think that's a good place for all of us to start if we're going to quote the Bible and put religion in the forefront on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just hope that God said you did what you thought was right, and for that we're going to let you in. We're going to open the gates.
Do you have any last thought you would like to add, something I may not have asked you, but you would like to say something about?
Well, I just feel very good about what I was able to do on this issue. And would hope that we could get more people to join us and to be a part of this movement. It's very difficult for people to accept in a lot of cases. When you see how horrendous some of these crimes are, it's a natural thing for people to want to have some kind of retribution or revenge in some fashion. But I think that we've got to find a little softer spot in our hearts and have a little better understanding. I believe that life in prison without parole is a fate worse than death. And I think most prisoners that are in there will tell you the same thing. They would probably rather be executed than to face life in prison, where they have to sit and think about what they did and think about it for the rest of their lives.
Thank you so much, Governor Ryan.
Well, I'm sorry for my voice this morning, but I appreciate the opportunity to at least talk about this issue on the scale that you've given me.